Is higher education doomed? Andrew Delbanco is here to talk about two new books that say the American university is in big trouble.
There are serious reasons to be concerned. The costs are out of control. The student debt problem is a real problem. There's a lot of evidence that students aren't learning enough in college.
Wait, a new book from J.R.R. Tolkien? Andrew O'Hare will tell us about the latest posthumous discovery.
And I think he was experimenting with taking this really classic English, you know, fantasy, fairy tale, legend, whatever you want to call it, and turning it to his own purposes.
Why isn't Christine Quinn's memoir selling? Julie Bosman has notes from the field, and Greg Coles will be here to talk about the bestseller lists. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Andrew Delbanco is here. He is the director of American Studies at Columbia University and appropriately talking about two books about higher education. The first is College Worth It? A former United States Secretary of Education and a liberal arts graduate exposed the broken promise of higher education, by William J. Bennett, writing with David Wolesel. William J. Bennett, obviously Secretary of Education under Reagan. And the second book is College Unbound, The Future of Higher Education and What It Means for Students, by Jeffrey Salingo. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So these two books take a pretty gloomy look at the state of higher ed in America.
There are reasons for gloom, but there have always been reasons for gloom. If you put a library together of all the books that said that higher education was on the brink, you'd have a very big bookshelf. But there are serious reasons to be concerned. The costs are out of control. The student debt problem is a real problem. And there's a lot of evidence that students aren't learning enough in college.
And now, when you say the costs are out of control, meaning the costs both for the universities and running themselves and the costs for students?
Well, that's an important distinction. The costs are for the universities and the price for students. There's a distinction there. And there's a lot of confusion about the relation between those two. So, for example, at private institutions where the sticker price is shockingly high, in fact, every student is subsidized to some degree. That is, the cost of educating those students is actually higher than the price that they pay. So one concern I have is that the public really needs to understand these complexities better than they do. I think the Salingo book helps a little bit to getting us to a better place of understanding.
And one of the things, you just make the distinction right away between private and public institutions. It seems to me that it's such a broad thing to talk about college because you have so many things in there. You're talking about places that are community colleges. I think the point's been made recently, you probably made it yourself, that the vast majority of colleges are not even selective colleges.
That's quite correct. It is very dangerous to make broad generalizations about college with a capital C, because one of the great strengths of the American higher education system has always been its variety. So, for example, Salingo is properly concerned that at some institutions there are too many luxuries, too many amenities, money being wasted. But at most institutions, I think that's probably not true. Certainly not at the community colleges where roughly a third of American undergraduates attend. I don't think we would be bowled over by the luxuries and amenities at those institutions.
And the life of the faculty is very different at these kind of institutions. You have people that are basically working with no health insurance and no security versus your tenure.
Exactly right. When I was in college, I think something like three quarters of American professors were either tenured or on a tenure track. Today, it's exactly the other way around. Only about a quarter of today's professors have real job security. And there are some profound implications to that. People working at two, sometimes even three institutions can't give the kind of attention to their students that others can do.
So, okay, we've already got one major problem going on, or several. What else? Why the hand-wringing right now? What's troubling William J. Bennett, for example?
Well, I think, you know, since the economic downturn of 2007-08, people are properly sensitive to what they're getting for their money and how much stress is being put on the individual family's bank account by the cost of education. And that's perfectly reasonable to be concerned about that. But we want to understand, for instance, that a very large part of that problem has been created by the disinvestment in public institutions by the states. That is, the cost of educating those students remains high, but the cost is being transferred from the taxpayer to the students and their families.
And just to give some numbers here for those who aren't looking gloomily at their paltry 529 accounts or their student debts, what are we talking about in terms of private education and also in terms of public on average?
I don't have the numbers on hand, but I think it's fair to say that the very dramatic numbers one hears are usually at the margins. That is, most students have significant debt, but it's manageable debt. And I think if we think collectively and carefully about perhaps repayment programs keyed to future income and the like, the student debt problem is manageable. And another feature of it that I think we want to keep in mind is that the very rapid expansion of the for-profit universities has also contributed a lot toward that debt.
And, of course, the acronym on tip of everyone's tongue is MOOCs, although I don't think everyone knows what those are. Can you tell us what's a MOOC?
Right.
And what does that mean?
Well, it's a very fast-changing landscape. About a year ago, I think the word MOOC didn't exist. It stands for Massive Open Online Course. And there's been a lot of drama about them. It started with a Stanford professor who decided that why should he teach 200 students in a classroom when he could go online and teach them all over the world? So he took his introductory computer science course online and quickly had an enrollment of about 160,000. So there's a lot of excitement about these courses. I think there's a lot of good things about them. Who can argue against spreading knowledge and educational opportunity around the world? But I think if we regard these online strategies as a silver bullet, we're probably going in the wrong direction. The fact is, the vast majority of people who enroll in MOOCs are people who already have college degrees. It's also true that the
baby boomers going back for a little bit more.
That's right. It's also true that the completion rate, the number of people who actually finish the MOOC, is extremely low, much lower even than the rather unsatisfactory completion rates at our physical colleges and universities.
Well, it also, I mean, it raises the question of what is the value of a college education? Is it about just this transference of knowledge and information? Is it, as you say, Bennett suggests, also about partying, and or is it, you know, the reason everybody says the great value of the Ivy League education is in who you meet and those contacts, that network?
Yeah, it's easy to take pot shots at colleges, and they're certainly imperfect institutions. They're inefficient. There's a lot of time wasting. Students of this generation, as has always been the case, waste a lot of their time in college.
As of every preceding generation. Well,
that's right. I mean, you read the literature of American higher education, you can find the same complaints 100 years ago that they were partying all night. But that's not to say that these problems are not real. At the same time, we want to recognize that the American college has been a very distinctive and precious institution that has been the envy of the rest of the world. And one thing that troubles me about these two books is that they don't give very much attention to what makes the American college distinctive. One of the things that makes it distinctive is that we have always believed that students have a great deal to learn from each other, something that's hard to imagine in an online circumstance. So we want to be careful that we don't, as it were, throw out the baby with the bathwater. Reform, yes. Eradication, no.
Right. And the sort of serendipity that takes place in a classroom where a conversation, a discussion takes root and goes in an unexpected direction.
Exactly so. And that serendipity pertains to the students talking with each other and the professor. When I walk into my classroom, I never know quite what's going to happen because I don't know what objections and reactions I'm going to get from my students. And that's what makes it fun and always interesting.
So Bennett and Salingo are both saying higher ed is in trouble, but they see different reasons for this.
Well, Mr. Bennett basically thinks that we should go to a business model for higher education.
So it's Germany.
Well, that we should, as a society, track more students away from post-secondary broad liberal education and into vocational training, that students and their families should do financial calculations in advance about how much the degree is going to be worth to them over their lifetime.
So sort of return on investment.
Right, which seems to me a rather improbable strategy for most young people.
I mean, it's interesting that this is coming from the person who is so interested in character and in values and in those sort of intangibles that are imparted by a solid education.
Exactly so. I think there's some strange contradictions to his argument that I talk about a little bit in the review. Salingo is, I would say, more interested in reforming the existing institutions, more interested in incorporating into them online technologies, which makes a lot of sense because students are already online most of the day and half the night, in order to make learning more effective, in order to enable faculties to measure whether their students are learning. And there's a certain utopianism in Salingo's book, even as he is brutally honest about the problems we currently face.
Now, you obviously work in academia up at Columbia, but what in their argument sort of had the most relevance or seemed to be the most sort of true in your experience?
Well, to be honest, a place like where I work is pretty insulated from these problems. And I think that's a problem for us. It means that a lot of faculty members and especially privileged students have their heads somewhat in the sand about what the reality is out there. If you're at an institution where there are scores of thousands of people around the world who want to come there and pay whatever you charge, you're not terribly worried about the future, although I think there are reasons to be concerned even at the wealthy institutions. So I think both of these books do a service in painting with a rather broad brush the broad picture in American higher education, and they are wake-up calls, and we should pay attention. But what the answer is going to be different at each institution. Each institution has its own traditions, serves its own constituency, and I think we want to be careful about broad-gauge strategies for dealing with what is a very complicated problem.
All right. Well, think about this, I guess, before signing off on the $65,000 a year tuition and room and board bill. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
That was Andrew Delvanco talking about his review of two books that look at the value of higher education. Is College Worth It? A former United States Secretary of Education and a liberal arts graduate exposed the broken promise by William J. Bennett and David Wiliesel, and College Unbound, the future of higher education and what it means for students by Jeffrey Salingo. Thank you, Andrew.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, written and read by David Sedaris. That's Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman, our publishing reporter, is here. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So what is going on?
So this week we have a story that publishers and a certain politician probably doesn't like, but it's interesting from the reader's perspective, and that is the New York City mayoral race is, I think you could say, it's in full swing. The contenders are lining up, and Christine Quinn, who is considered the front runner in the mayoral race, has released a memoir last week. and we have the first week of sales.
Not good, I take it.
Not good. According to Nielsen BookScan, which is the, you know, industry standard for measuring book sales, Christine Quinn's memoir has sold about 100 print copies in the first week.
Now, Nielsen, that captures about 80% of sales. Is that the rough estimate?
That's right. About 80, 85%. And it depends on the book, of course, but they have Walmart, Target, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Books A Million, all of the major retailers. The only thing that BookScan doesn't capture is specialty stores like Urban Outfitters and, you know,
got it,
museum stores.
So 100 books, not looking good.
Not looking good. And this is interesting because this is a classic campaign strategy. You want to introduce yourself to voters using very carefully chosen words. You want to present some lovely, gauzy, black and white photos of you as a child and, you know, growing up and your family, and tell potential voters who you are and what your platform is. And William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins, bought this book. The title is With Patience and Fortitude, of course, a reference to the lions in front of the New York Public Library, which Christine Quinn apparently finds personally touching. And the book, which was released on June 11th, is, you know, a very slim book. It was released in hardcover, of course. And she writes a lot about her struggles with alcoholism, with bulimia. She includes a lot of personal stuff about her wedding last year.
We wrote a lot of the juicy bits. We covered that in the paper here.
Yes, we did. We wrote a pretty big story about what was in the book. But, you know, it says something about the interest in this book that you can't even find it in Christine Quinn's own neighborhood, Chelsea. You know, we went to Posman Books and asked them if they had the book. They had ordered a few copies, but they hadn't arrived. The Barnes & Noble in the Village is no longer there. It's kind of a bookstore-less area downtown Manhattan these days. So there was a Borders in that area, but of course that was gone as of 2011.
Do we know what they paid for this book?
We don't. I mean, I don't believe they paid a huge advance. I think it was appropriately modest. And HarperCollins did not have any kind of comment whatsoever on what they think about the fact that this book has only sold 100 copies.
And this should be, I mean, it should be a big mayoral race. You've got Bloomberg leaving office and very colorful figures like Anthony Weiner and, of course, Christine Quinn, openly gay, sort of protege or has become kind of a protege of Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
Not much interest.
Apparently not. I mean, I think that there's probably a lot of campaign fatigue in the air. I think that everyone paid very, very close attention to the presidential election. And, you know, we're still kind of shaking that off. I mean, I think that most people really don't know who Chris Quinn is, even though she's been a very high profile figure in terms of city politics. You know, she's running against Anthony Weiner, who we know is very high profile for other reasons, and Bill de Blasio, the public advocate. I would guess that most New Yorkers probably don't know who the public advocate is. So I think this is partially a reflection of the fact that the public just isn't really ready to read a lot about the mayoral race.
Does it say anything bigger about campaign books? It seems like, you know, there are two categories. You either have the, this is what I'm going to do when I'm in office, or as you said earlier, this sort of more personal origin story. Have these books been selling well?
It really depends who it is. You know, I think a lot of publishers really like publishing these books because you get a relatively big name.
Lots of media.
Lots of media, you know, just guaranteed media. You know that your author is going to get on cable news shows. You know that there's going to be a lot of write-ups of the book.
And book sales.
Book sales. You usually don't have to pay these people very, very much, depending who it is. And there are always tons of these books, especially around election years. Even, I think, in 2012, Herman Cain came up with a book that was, I think it was purchased or was acquired before he decided he was going to run for president. So every now and then, a publisher can kind of strike gold with one of these books. But it's almost always the personal books that sell much, much better than the, you know, here's my political platform and here's what I do. I mean, you can see that in President Obama's two books, and just how much more his first book sold than his second book, which I don't think very many people read it at all, because when you're introducing yourself to voters, people really want to know your biography.
But apparently not the biography of Christine Quinn.
Not yet.
Well, thanks, Julie.
Thanks, Pamela.
Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, and now The Fall of Arthur. Andrew O'Hare is here to talk about a new book from J.R.R. Tolkien. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
So Tolkien obviously died in 1973 or 83?
I think it was 1973.
So where did this book come from?
Well, you know, his son, Christopher Tolkien, who is now himself 88 years of age, has been for many years exhuming things from these boxes and boxes of unfinished manuscripts that his father left behind. And obviously, there's an enormous fan base because of The Lord of the Rings that is interested in even the most marginal things that Tolkien wrote and did not finish.
Reading scribbles on toilet paper.
In some cases, it almost approaches that. We're dealing in some cases with fragmentary handwritten manuscripts, ideas for things. And what I would say about Christopher Tolkien is that he's been very transparent about the condition of manuscripts when he finds them. And this represents a poem that Tolkien started at some point in the 1930s, probably about 1932 or 33, and abandoned by the year 1937, which probably not coincidentally is the year that The Hobbit was published, the work that really introduced him to a wide popular audience for the first time.
And so this is not the first posthumous work that Christopher has brought forth.
By no means. Indeed, since 1973, I wouldn't even hazard a guess as to how many volumes of with Tolkien's name on them have come out, probably in the range of 20 or so, some of which are things that, by Christopher's admission, he's put together himself, acting as a kind of co-author. In this case, that's not what happened. This is actually a poem that Tolkien intended to finish based on the Arthurian legends. But there have been other poems, other partial manuscripts. This may be the last, given Christopher Tolkien's age, but it also may not be. I don't know what else is left in the vault.
So between sort of scribbles and scraps and masterworks, where does this one fall?
I think it's a really interesting in-between. I think it's a look at what might have been. It's an attempt to write the story of Arthur, of King Arthur of the Arthurian legends, and the episode that leads to his death, which involves the adulterous relationship between his trusted Sir Lancelot and his queen Guinevere, and a calamitous battle that occurs in England as he's trying to defend the realm against Saxon invaders. And it's written in the alliterative verse style of the early Middle Ages, which is in itself kind of peculiar because that's not contemporaneous with when King Arthur would have lived. If he lived at all, he was an earlier figure than that. But I think it's actually marvelous poetry, but in a funny way, kind of a dead end for Tolkien, because he didn't wind up writing the Arthurian legends. He wrote his own set of legends. And I think he was experimenting with taking this really classic English, you know, fantasy, fairy tale, legend, whatever you want to call it, and turning it to his own purposes.
And this is unfinished, and Christopher has not finished it.
He did not attempt, no. Every word of the poem that we get in this book is J.R.R. Tolkien's own writing. It's about 4+ cantos, roughly 40 pages of a work that was probably intended to run somewhere in the range of 80 to 100 pages. It's likely slightly less than half of what would have been a completed manuscript.
But we know it ended in death.
Yeah, we do kind of know how it ends. Yes, it is called The Fall of Arthur. And in all versions of the story, and certainly in this one, we know that Arthur at the end dies and is sent to someplace called the Isle of Avalon, where some sort of immortal fairyland paradise situation where his wound will be healed. In this particular story, Tolkien is going away from previous published sources a little bit, but it's still a fairly familiar story with familiar characters.
Is he doing anything new that's interesting with the Arthurian legend?
Well, as I said, it's written in what's called the alliterative verse style, the verse style used in Beowulf and other famous medieval poems. That in itself is an interesting turn of events. There are alliterative verse poems about Arthur. He's sort of enlisting himself in a medieval tradition. And I think it's tremendous gorgeous for the most part. The poetry is really marvelous. It's an attempt to write using a modern English vocabulary in a really antique verse style. And some of it, particularly the battle sequences, are really startling and vivid.
Now, you bring up the importance of language here, and there's an interesting parallel. Christopher Tolkien, obviously, publishing his late father's work, and your father was, like Tolkien, a linguist, a philologist. What did that bring to this reading experience for you?
Well, it was fascinating for me to read this. My father was a linguist and philologist, not exactly in precisely the same field as Tolkien, who was especially a specialist in Old English primarily. My father was interested in the Celtic languages, which are geographically very close, of course, but linguistically somewhat different. But Tolkien could read the Celtic languages. My father could read Old English. They probably overlapped in some areas. And to me, what it brought forth is that there is a kind of a misfit here, or a poor match between the material, which is essentially Celtic in origin. If there ever was a King Arthur, he would have lived sometime around the 5th or 6th century AD, and would have spoken a language that was a Celtic language, somewhat akin to modern Welsh, maybe. Tolkien is trying to put this in an Anglo-Saxon verse style, something that didn't exist in England at the time, and is exactly coming from the people whom King Arthur, if he existed, was trying to defeat. And I honestly think that the odd quality, that the pastiche or mismatch that's going on there, is one of the reasons why he didn't choose to finish the work. Christopher Tolkien suggests, perhaps correctly, that Tolkien was experimenting with the idea of attaching his own legends, the legends that would later become the Lord of the Rings, about the hobbits and the Great War of the Ring and all of those things, to connect that with Arthurian legend. I think it's possible that he was experimenting with that, but I think what this manuscript suggests is that he decided it wasn't worth doing in the end.
Now, for your Lord of the Rings devotees, of which there are many, what is there for them in this book? I mean, are there sort of interesting origins or threads, as you suggest, of what was to come?
Yeah, Christopher Tolkien writes a long and very careful essay about the connections between this manuscript, these 40 pages or so of The Fall of Arthur, to the Tolkien legendarium, the word that he uses, and in particular the Silmarillion. Tolkien fans will already know what that is. It's the body of legends that sort of lies behind the Lord of the Rings story, which again was also not published until after Tolkien's death, although it was essentially complete or almost complete. And I think he makes a case correctly that Tolkien was seeing parallels and points of connection between Arthurian legend and his own invented legends, and was playing around with the idea of connecting all the legends of, I think Christopher uses the phrase, the people who live by the Western Seas, meaning the Britons, the Celts, the Northern Europeans in general, trying to see if he could connect all of those existing legends together in a way that would intersect with his own imaginative universe. And I think that's really fascinating. Christopher Tolkien is very careful about the conclusions that he draws. He is an extremely careful scholar when it comes to his father's work. But I think for Tolkien fans, for Lord of the Rings fans, for the real devotees, that's the core of this book. The essay itself is longer than the poem that it's discussing.
All right. Well, plenty of fodder here for those who are waiting for the next Hobbit installment from Peter Jackson. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Pamela.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So, hell is still at the top of the list with Dan Brown's Inferno.
Dan Brown's Inferno.
But what's new?
Okay, so on the combined fiction list this week, again, a strong showing from self-published authors, which tends to be the case on the combined list. The top new title on the combined fiction list is a self-published title by Abby Glines. It's the final book in a trilogy, a romance called Forever Too Far. Then at number five, Carl Hiaasen's new novel, Bad Monkey, is new on the combined fiction list. And he's been kicking around on the kids' middle book list with a book called Chomp. That's near the bottom of that list at number 10, I think.
Alligators and Monkeys.
Alligators and Monkeys. That book, Chomp, has been on the kids' middle grade list for 4 weeks now. Then at number 8, Jeanette Walls, the author of The Glass Castle, a memoir of her terrible childhood, is new on the list with a novel called The Silver Star. This is her second novel, but readers may remember that her first novel was basically just a fictionalized version of her grandmother's life. This is her first true novel, a truly invented story. And in some ways, it puts to rights her bad childhood. It's a novel about a bad childhood, but one where the daughter really stands up to the mother. That's new on the list at number 8. At number 10, J.C. Reed, another self-published author, has a romance novel called Conquer Your Love. At number 11, the longtime thriller writer Steve Barry has a book called The King's Deception. This is part of his Cotton Malone series. These books are sort of like the Magic Treehouse for grown-ups. They're set in the present, but the hero, Cotton Malone, often is looking into big mysteries from the past. So he doesn't travel to the past the way that the protagonists of the kids of the Magic Treehouse
do. Is there a treehouse?
There is no treehouse. But he looks into kind of conspiracies and things. He's an ex-government operative. He used to work for the Justice Department. And in this one, he's looking into England's historical claims on Ireland. That's called The King's Deception. It's new at number 11. And finally, on the combined fiction list this week, Dorothea Benton Frank, another longtime bestseller, has a book called The Last Original Wife. She writes these kind of homey South Carolina low country novels. Good beach reading, smart, funny. This one has an interesting premise. It's called The Last Original Wife. It is about a woman in middle age whose husband's friends have all divorced their first wives and married kind of the Barbie trophy wife as their second wives. And so this last original wife is finding her social circle falling away as one by one these other wives are cast off. And it leaves her feeling a little bit adrift and wondering what her role is. Her husband thinks that she should be grateful to him just for the fact that he's kept her around. And she's starting to ask what she really wants out of life. And so she takes a little break and goes back home to the South Carolina low country to hang out on the beach and get in touch with who she really is. So it's kind of a woman's middle-aged crisis novel.
And it looks like this week also marks more than a year on the combined list for Gone Girl.
Yeah.
Speaking of anniversaries.
It has crossed the one-year mark. It's 53 weeks on the combined list for Gone Girl and 54 weeks on the hardcover list for that one. So it has crossed that one-year mark and seems like it'll still be going strong.
And anything new in nonfiction?
Just one new book in nonfiction. This is new on the combined list and on the hardcover list, and it's the only new title on either of those lists. It's a book called Collapse of Dignity by a guy named Napoleon Gomez. What's interesting about this book is it's been out for a couple of months, and it tells the story of the 2006 mine collapse in Mexico that the government kind of rushed its investigation. Gomez is a labor leader, a union leader, who accuses the government and the mining company of covering up the problems with that mine. He says that there were a lot of indications beforehand that conditions weren't safe there. He's in exile in Canada. He's been accused of various crimes, which he claims, again, are just an attempt to silence him. And what's interesting is that I can't see that this book was on an Amazon Daily deal. I haven't found that he's made any talk show appearances or other kind of media appearances. Yet it's been out for a couple of months, and suddenly just now it's turning up on the list. So sometimes our listeners know why a book is suddenly selling well, even when I can't find evidence.
Let us know at books@nytimes.com.
It does seem like an interesting book, and this guy is kind of a firebrand, and it's quite a compelling story and a tragedy that he's shedding light on.
Well, listeners, let us know if you know something we don't.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, Greg. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.